good to be amongst friends. I am very happy to be with you all. I feel very welcome. The right companionship and the right companions, the Sangha, means so very much. It is an influence for the best. It is not always possible to stand up against the cruelty of circumstance, the stress and strain of successive situations. But in a situation like this, there is ease, there is harmony, there is inward peace. So I thank you all for allowing me this companionship. Where there is stress and conflict, there is ill health. But where one has the right situation, where there is a state of harmony, there is well-being. Now, companions sometimes, perhaps often, feast together. Let us together enjoy a feast. But I am a poor man. I have but very little to place before you for your repast. Maybe a little hors d'oeuvre and I was not quite certain what would follow until yesterday when one of our speakers here supplied me with what perhaps is a very felicitous term, tripe. When the Buddha accepted someone, he said, "Come, Bhikkhu, tread the Brahma path, the Brahmacharya, for the utter ending of dukkha." The Brahma path. Significant words. And in this connection, remember this is just hors d'oeuvre, no exposition, just expanding, which is telling what you yourself may have discovered to be true, telling what may have been your own experience and your own realization. In this connection, think of the Brahma Viharas. The question is asked, what is the way to union with Brahma? And the Buddha gives the great teaching of the Brahma Viharas, which is a pre-Buddhistic teaching. to suffuse one quarter of the world with a mind full of loving kindness, Metta. Far-reaching, widespread, infinite, and so on. And then with Karuna, compassion, with Mudita, sympathetic joy, as it is sometimes translated, with Upekha. Now, friends, what does this mean? Do I sit here and try and imagine the universe divided into four quarters and then sort of fill one quarter with what? And then another quarter and then another quarter. What does it all mean? What is it substantially? The world is the world of my awareness. In my own mind, I hold my world. I have no other world. The external objective world is tremendous, immense, beyond computation, impossible to picture in its substantive wholeness. I can't think of a universe which is 2,000 million light years across and divide it into four parts and suffuse it with this, that, and the other. And if I did, no one would be the better for it. Or if I tried to do it. What do I actually do? In my own mind, in my own mental storehouse of mental impressions, is my world. People, things, and so on, events, and all the rest of it. In connection with each and every one of them, there is associated love, hate, fear, jealousy, envy, dislike, indifference, and so on. But I take every one of those, which I can do, in my own world, and suffuse it with friendliness. What is this friendliness, this metta? Is it perhaps my own ill will and enmity transformed? I cannot destroy enmity. I cannot destroy ill will. There are forces in my own being. Nothing can be destroyed, but everything can be transformed. There is a principle of conservation throughout all existence. Material, psychical, etc. I can effect a transformation. That's my job. I bear somebody ill will, enmity. I look at it. And I take that person in my thought and suffuse that in me, myself, not the person. The person's miles away. I can't do anything. I can't send out any waves across. But in my own mind, this person whom I bear ill will, whom I regard as an enmity, I suffuse that part of my own mind, which is occupied by him, with metta, with friendliness. Understanding that the ill will and the enmity is my own confusion and fear and avidya. And so I purify that within my own self and slowly free myself from ill will and enmity. And so if and when I meet that person again, I have a better chance of forming a right relationship with him. In the same way, with things and objects, I may be one of those who heartily dislike jet planes, such noisy little things. But if I suffuse my jet plane inside my own mind with a sense of friendliness, accepting the jet plane, so if I don't accept it, the jet plane won't be worried by it, then I free myself from sources of disharmony, and I can behave rightly towards the jet plane when I meet one. And so on. So this metta, with my own transformed ill will and enmity, which has become friendliness. But what do I suffuse? Only that which is within my own mind. And the same with karuna, compassion. I can't go suffusing the whole human race with compassion. I don't know 2,750 million people, and I don't want to know them. Difficult enough to manage those who I already know. But this happens inside my own mind. Karuna, compassion. Healing grief is karuna. I can't get rid of grief. It will always come in some form or other. But what was formerly grief on my own account was self-pity and all sorts of foolish things like that. It's transformed. And it has become compassion. If someone who is my neighbor, who is near and dear to me, or who is not my neighbor and not particularly near and dear to me, is hurt, then I feel grief. But being something which is transformed, it is a healing grief. It is compassion. And take mudita, sympathetic joy. How much envy and jealousy we have in ourselves. And it seems to me that if I transform that envy and jealousy, understand that this person here, commonly called I, is not a separate entity with specific rights and privileges which must be defended and fought for against another, then I can gradually get rid of that envy and jealousy. But what I am doing is I am transforming the psychic force from within myself, which is envy and jealousy, into a delight, a happiness in somebody else's happiness and well-being. Even if I don't agree with that form of happiness as being worthwhile or good, say, for myself. That's neither here nor there. My neighbor is happy, all right. I am happy with him in his happiness. Little Pekka. Equanimity, as it is called, mistranslated by very clever people as indifference, but a perfect balance is not at all static. Tremendously active equanimity, but it is unmoving. It is a dynamic poise. What have I transformed there? Are we not all full of likes and dislikes? The mere reaction of our pattern of being to all other patterns of being, living and non-living, likes and dislikes. Emotionally attached acceptances and emotionally repelling rejections. They have no place in the life of a man who has become man. They have place in the life of the subhuman. So understanding it that way, looking at these likes and dislikes, I transform that energy, which are likes and dislikes, into a whole acceptance, a complete acceptance of everything that is, living or non-living. An acceptance which is not condemnatorily critical, which is not blindly, sentimentally accepting. I see that person is a wonderful good person. I see that person is a terrible scoundrel. But I accept both equally. That person is one version of myself. I am one version of him. That person also is another version of myself, and I am another version of him. Because even if I am so purified and perfected that I am the Buddha, he and I are one. And if he and I are one in the real sense, in my own awareness, then he is helped by the fact that I am fully conscious that he and I are one. Otherwise, I can do little, if anything at all, to help him. So here we have the Brahma Viharas, the godlike, the divine residences, if you like to use such terms, the way to union with Brahma. Let us pass on from that order to something else. dukkha. You always hear the word dukkha in the study, in Buddhist study, in connection with the Buddha's teaching. It is said that the fundamental teaching, the fundamental statement made by the Buddha is dukkha and the ceasing of dukkha. Or if you like, deliverance from dukkha, I proclaim. Well, what is dukkha? You hear the usual things: bodily pain, ill health, suffering, and so on. There is the emotional grief of heart, woe, lamentation over calamity, and so on. There is mental distress, and so on. There is dukkha because of circumstance, because of people. Being related to that which is not welcome to oneself, which is not pleasant, not being related to or associated with that which is dear to one, and so on. And the way, the treading of the way is supposed to bring about the ceasing of dukkha. But after you become a Buddha, you will still fall ill physically. If you tread upon a thorn, you will jump. If you have bitterly ice-cold winds blowing at you, you will shiver and suffer pain. You will catch cold, you will have a stomachache. You will need a doctor's assistance physically, as the Buddha himself did. You will still feel grief at the sufferings of others. Healing grief, but still it will be grief, a form of dukkha. What is the meaning of this overcoming dukkha? If you never felt bodily pain, suffering, or ill health, and so on, why, the body will continue to go on forever, possibly. That perhaps may not be very desirable on the planet. What? Is there something profounder, deeper, where this dukkha is concerned? We always hear of the externals of dukkha. Is there an internal, so to say, of dukkha? And after all, is it really necessary to go to such an extent as to tread the path, the Brahma path, and attain Buddhahood in order to overcome or to stand up against or to deal with, like any man or decent man or woman would deal with, ill health or loss of property or the ill behavior of someone, of some people towards you, or conditions of war or anything like that at all? You can do it standing on your own 2 feet. You are a man, you are a woman. You can take it in your stride. Many people do take it in their stride. What then is the dukkha which cannot be taken in one stride in the ordinary way of the decent man, the well-educated man, the cultured man, the trained man? What is it that requires this deeper education, this profounder culture, cultivating, and so on? You know, in the Chandogya Upanishad, there's a very lovely chapter, chapter 7, where Narada, the great sage who knows everything, approaches Sanat Kumara, and Sanat Kumara means the eternal child, and says, "Teach me, Master." And Sanat Kumara says, "Tell me what you already know." Narada says, "I know the Rig Veda and the Yajur Veda and the Sama Veda and the Atharva Veda and so on and so on. He knows politics, grammar, logic, rhetoric, the science of snakes, the science of demonology, this, that, and the other. In fact, he's a walking encyclopedia. A real walking encyclopedia. We have, even in modern times, people of tremendous intellect who have an encyclopedic knowledge. There's hardly anything Narada couldn't do. But, sir," says Narada, "I am as one who knows the words of all these things, but I do not know the Atma. I have been told by those who are like you, sir, that he who knows the Atma crosses over all sorrow." And the words he uses are sokam tarati, not dukkha. Sokam tarati, crosses over sorrow. So Sanat Kumara, and then he ends up by saying, "Teach me how to realize the Atma." So Sanat Kumara says, "Well, all that you know is mere name. And then Sanat Kumara leads him on step to step, step by step, till he comes to the infinite. The infinite, the non-dual, the all-inclusive. And says, here there is infinite bliss. Here there is the crossing over of all sorrow. But this deep sorrow, this profoundest of all sorrow, is not knowing the Atma. Please do not regard Atma as soul, self." These words, which have come into common usage, are all right up to a point and misleading beyond that point. Because in the modern world, words like soul and self stand for entity, that which is limited and particular, not that which is infinite. Just tentatively, for the moment, supposing we regard Atma as the uttermost, the ultimate. Atta, the ultimate. We can just say the word ultimate. We can't postulate anything about it, because the moment we do it, it is no longer ultimate. So we just say ultimate. We say Atma. We stop there. Now, try to regard Atma that way. So it is not realizing the Atma which is the sorrow, the suffering. Now, you know how it is said that when Rahula was born, there was the usual public holiday, I suppose, and city of Kapilavastu was ordered to be happy, and everyone in due obedience to the order was as happy as he or she could be, and all the usual show
And as Gautama Siddhartha was coming through the street, one lady said certain words which made him think, and he felt ultimate repose. How does one get that? Nirvana. How does one get that? The sun is born to me, an impediment in the way of that ultimate repose, that ultimate peace. The sublime, unoriginated nirvana, as Dr. Oldenburg translated in the last century. That sublime, unoriginated nirvana. So, Siddhartha too felt that sorrow, did not know the ultimate, the uttermost, which is Nibbana. How to realize that was the supreme dukkha. And it was perhaps to solve that and not old age, disease, all the rest of it, it just comes and goes. And quite honestly, friends, we can take it in our stride. And if we can't, we just have to. Most of us do. But this other thing needed something beyond the ordinary, right away beyond the ordinary. How much beyond the ordinary is indicated by subsequent history. Siddhartha goes to Alara Kalama, who, it is said, takes him to the plane of no thing. Takes him to the plane of no thing. He achieves that, goes to another teacher, because that wasn't the end of the story. Who takes him one step further to the plane of neither consciousness nor unconsciousness, or if you like, neither perception nor non-perception. But that too was not Nibbana. A limited particular state from which you came back and lost that all-pervasive, transmutative something which is the uttermost. It didn't come through here and now. So he had to make the effort alone. There were no teachers in his day who could take him to the ultimate. In his case, he did it alone. And he goes one step further, the stopping of feeling and perception, as it is called, and realize that ultimate state, Nibbana. In discourse after discourse, in the Majjhima Nikaya, for instance, you will find this repeated, just categorically repeated over and over again. The eight or nine, sometimes, as they are made out to be, stations of deliverance. What are these deliverances? These deliverances are states of consciousness. States of consciousness. Becoming profounder and profounder in the sense that the limited and the particular is being transcended. Not suppressed, not forgotten, but transcended. The nature of that transcendence can never be put in analytical terms, but experience it and you know it. Just as no description of what a banana tastes like will ever really convey to you until you have eaten the banana. The Buddha, in his teachings, includes what was taught by Alara Kalama and Uddhaka Ramakutta.
Brahman teaches
something which we must not forget. And the Buddha completes the whole thing, realizes Nibbana. What happened to him on the night of the deliverance? What happened? We are told in the writing that in the 3 watches of the night, he goes through the Paticca Samuppada. This is how ill dukkha originates. This is the ending of dukkha. But we are not told in black and white. If we are, please, I must be corrected because I haven't read all the scriptures. We are not told that he went through these different states of consciousness till he reached that end state, the stopping of feeling and perception. I'll put that in my own words, which I first put in 1952. The deliberate stopping in full self-possession, in full waking consciousness, of all discursive thinking and feelings and pictures as they pass through through the mind. The deliberate stopping of them. That is that final stage beyond neither perception nor perception, nor non-perception. What does it imply? All discursive thinking is a string of words. Sit down and try over and over again. See what happens as long as you're awake. There's a string of words passing through your mind, or pictures, or you're aware of feeling. Perpetually you are aware of the limited and the particular. Every word represents limited, particular entity. Can you say, like a policeman says to the traffic, stop, and it stops? That is the faculty of the mind which is developed. It was developed by the great rishis who composed the Vedas. It is there in the Upanishads. It is there in this particular presentation as achieved and taught by the Buddha. In the Katha Upanishad, for instance, you will find, he who seeks this ultimate, the Lord of Death himself gives the teaching to Nachiketa. The wise man should suppress speech. I think I'll use my own word. The scholars use the word suppress, which I don't like. The wise man should subdue, and I'll define subdue for you. The wise man should subdue speech in mind. The mind he should subdue in jnana atma. The jnana atma he should subdue in the great atma, mahantma. And that he should subdue in the chanta atma. 4 stages, rather interesting. 4 jhanas, very interesting. Speech in the mind. The mind in the jnana atma. Now, atma not a self or soul. The uttermost knowing. A state of consciousness which you enter into. That
you subdue in the great Atma, the profounder state of consciousness, and that finally in the Santa Atma, uttermost peace, Nirvana. Subdue. And by subdue I mean control and transcend by emerging into the profounder state of consciousness. That is the meaning of subdue. Yet it. So now that is, I say, wonderful that a mortal should speak like that. So on the night of the deliverance, that is what the Buddha realized. That's what happened to him. Successfully stopped the flow of discursive thought and feelings and imaginings and so on. This faculty was fully developed. What interferes with us when we try to do this? Gautama discovered precisely what interferes. That is the paticca samuppada. Is expressed, is taught in the paticca samuppada. What interferes? Now, you all know the paticca samuppada, or at least have heard of it, some of you perhaps ad nauseam. But I'd like to start off with another 12 nidana system, which is not sufficiently talked about or addressed. Start with nidana, the knowledge of the extinction of the asura, the state of Vidya. Vidya means to me the fully awakened condition. Avidya means the unawakened condition. Not just knowing mathematics or not knowing mathematics. That is a very minor form application of the word vidya, avidya. Knowing mathematics, he has vidya regarding mathematics. Not knowing it, he hasn't. Vidya, in this context, is the fully awakened condition. Avidya, the unawakened condition. Knowledge of the extinction of the asuras. The asuras are translated as cankers, as intoxicants. I like to reject both those translations and regard it in its original meaning, overflow, exudation. If I have developed thus far, realized nirvana, I can maintain that pure consciousness, I beg your pardon, that utterly pure state of being in any consciousness in which I function, here, now, ordinarily, as I'm talking to you, or whether I'm entering this or that or the other profounder state of consciousness. That perfection, that transmutative, creative power comes through all conditions of being. That is the magic of the presence of the Great One. That is why it performs, I'll use the word, please forgive the use of it, I shouldn't, but still I'll use it, it performs miracles. So, afterwards, the overflowing of consciousness. What do you think? Supposing I am in the plane of no thing, very profound state of consciousness. You find it interesting mysticism to reduced to his own nothingness, as it is called. See? All right. Supposing I'm in the plane of nursing, and then something disturbs at my consciousness overflows just like that. There's an excitation. You saw the face I made, meaning something unpleasant. This is not my excitation. And overflow. What is that? Instead of being conscious of that, in that state, I'm conscious in a less complete state. What is the cause of that sudden spilling over of consciousness? Fundamentally, taking the ordinary dukkha paticca samuppada, the craving is the root of it, tanha. The lust for sensation of any and every sort, what we commonly call good, or what we commonly call bad, morally and in any other way, they're all alike, any sort of sensation. If you indulge in the sensation for the sublime of music, that is a source of being and after. That can just as much disturb you and to topple you over. You have a passion for the divine and so on, that is just as much toppling you over as if you had a passion for your neighbor's wife. So, tanha brings that about. Passion for sensation, the lust for sensation, for possession, for power, for self-expression, for becoming this, that and the other. So, all that comes under the realm of tanha. And every frustrated tanha, and 99.999% of our tanha is frustrated because the universe won't allow us to indulge in all that tanha, gets transformed into malevolence, ill will, hatred, resentment, separative criticism, too much analysis, and so on. You find it in a very subtle form in the works of wonderful scholars who are so learned, who are so clever, so penetrating that they take all that has been produced by the great teachers and then twist it round to show that their particular teacher is the real culminating point of all other teachers. So now you see, the knowledge of the extinction of the Arthava, Nibbana Vidya. And the Buddha teaches that it is causally connected with liberation. I think Mr. Woodward's translation, liberation, Vimukti, Vimukha, this would be a better word, please tell me. Freedom.
Freedom, I think.
Freedom. It's causally associated with freedom. And this is causally associated with, again, this word is used, passionlessness. Virago. Literally, a fading away. A fading away. I prefer fading away to passionlessness. Passionlessness has two definite, two clear-cut, and by that very clear-cutness, a rather limited significance and connotation in the English language. It's a fading away, it's a change in consciousness. And the thing changes, and as it changes, it fades away. One thing fades away into the other. I think it's better if you look at it that way. The next one is given as repulsion. I would rather like to put it not as repulsion, but as a turning away from, a conversion. Not the dramatic sensational conversions which we commonly associate with the word conversion, but very sensible, matter-of-fact, quiet
gentlemanly business.
Just a turn of conversion. You see? And that is causally associated with knowledge and vision into things as they really are. That is associated with concentration. A middle point, I would suggest, between that which is the consummation of samadhi, the real ultimate samadhi, which is the middle point, the stage of done like that. That is associated with happiness. This again is Mr. Woodward. As I would with you as. Opposite of dukkha, sukha. I rather like to translate it as well-being. Something very balanced, quiet, healthy, whole. The state of well-being. No excitement about it. Serenity, that is associated causally, says the Buddha, with serenity. That is associated with rapture, peace, rapture. Again, not the excited state, but that caught up in the right thing. And you know, yes, all going well, fine, remarkable. That's the sort of feeling, that's the sort of condition. Rapture associated, causally associated with joy, samadhi, which is causally associated with pain. Faith. I don't think that faith there is a credo, I believe. Faith. Now, you see why I say that. This is causally associated, says the Buddha, with dukkha, suffering. Now from here, we go up the other way, the usual way you all know, jara marana, jati, and so on, old age, death, and so on, birth, becoming, grasping, tanha, feeling, etc., right up to avidya. So we'll start avidya here, and sankhara, and so on. All the rest of it. You see? Now it is well worth while studying all this and seeing this peculiar statement that faith, prata, comes out of dukkha. Suffering is the indispensable link between the unawakened condition and the fully awakened condition. Pretty harshly critical of the Christian mystic who says, I love my suffering. There may be some profound meaning in it. I suppose I would not be standing here if I had not suffered. And rather contrary. Suffering moves one. One is moved by it. One has no special volition of one's own. One wants to get away from it. to run away, to escape, to back it, fight against it, to destroy it, all sorts of things. All these things fail until something happens. Ah!
I believe that will do it for me.
You try, you taste it, you savor it, you experiment with it. It becomes a little bit better. Something in you goes out to it and recognizes. Yes, this is it. This is right.
So, I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dhamma. I take refuge in the Sangha.
Refuge, again, is a word I don't like
in this context.
The Buddha is the haven towards which I am sailing. The Dhamma is the haven towards which I am sailing. The haven. Refuge is a place you've got, which you've got to ask, running away from something. No, I'm sailing towards it now. I'm running away from nobody. I'm not afraid. So you see, then that is a form of faith. And then practice of the way brings all this. In a frame of the Nibbana. You enjoyed the feast. Thank you.
Thank you, Emma.